From the Media Factory in the South End of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV-LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with award-winning authors Margot Livesey and Jill McCorkle, both of whom have new books out. Margot Livesey is the New York Times bestselling author of the novels The Flight of Gemma Hardy, The House on Fortune Street, Banishing Verona, Eva Moves the Furniture, The Missing World, Criminals, and Homework. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, Vogue, and The Atlantic, and she is the recipient of grants from both the National Endowment for the Arts and the Guggenheim Foundation. The House on Fortune Street won the 2009 L.L. Winship Penn New England Award. Born in Scotland, Margot Livesey currently lives in the Boston area and is a professor of fiction at the Iowa Writers' Workshop. Her new book is The Boy in the Field, published by Harper. One September afternoon in 1999, teenagers Matthew, Zoe, and Duncan Lang are walking home from school when they discover a boy lying in a field, bloody and unconscious. Thanks to their intervention, the boy's life is saved. In the aftermath, all three siblings are irrevocably changed. Matthew, the oldest, becomes obsessed with tracking down the assailant, secretly searching the local town with the victim's brother. Zoe wanders the streets of Oxford, looking at men, and one of them, a visiting American graduate student, looks back. Duncan, the youngest, who has seldom thought about being adopted, suddenly decides he wants to find his birth mother. Overshadowing all three is the awareness that something is amiss in their parents' marriage. Over the course of the autumn, as each of the siblings confronts the complications and contradictions of their approaching adulthood, they find themselves at once drawn together and driven apart. Jill McCorkle's first two novels were released simultaneously when she was just out of college, and the New York Times called her a born novelist. Since then, she has published 6 novels and 4 collections of short stories, and her work has appeared in Best American Short Stories several times, as well as the Norton Anthology of Short Fiction. 5 of her books have been New York Times notable books, and her novel Life After Life was a New York Times bestseller. She has received the New England Booksellers Award, the John Dos Passos Prize for Excellence in Literature, and the North Carolina Award for Literature. She has written for the New York Times Book Review, the Washington Post, the Boston Globe, Garden and Gun, the Atlantic, and other publications. She was a Briggs Copeland Lecturer in Fiction at Harvard, where she also chaired the Department of Creative Writing. She is currently a faculty member of the Bennington College Writing Seminars and is affiliated with the MFA program at North Carolina State University. Jill McCorkle's latest is Hieroglyphics, published by Algonquin. Lil and Frank, married young, launched into courtship when they bonded over how they both suddenly, tragically, lost a parent when they were children. Over time, their marriage grew and strengthened, with each still wishing for so much more understanding of the parents they had lost prematurely. Now, after many years in Boston, they've retired to North Carolina. There, Lil, determined to leave a history for their children, sifts through letters and notes and diary entries, perhaps revealing more secrets than Frank wants their children to know. Meanwhile, Frank has become obsessed with what might have been left behind at the house he lived in as a boy on the outskirts of town, where a young single mother, Shelley, is just trying to raise her son with some sense of normalcy. Frank's repeated visits to Shelley's house begin to trigger memories of her own family, memories that she had hoped to keep buried. Because after all, not all parents are ones you wish to remember. I spoke to Margot and Jill in tandem last week. Our primary subject was plotting the literary novel. Literary fiction is often described as valuing character development above all else, but the literary books I most enjoy always do seem to have plenty going on story-wise. Huge arguments seem to come out of studying literary fiction as apart from genre fiction, and I'm not really trying to encourage that kind of conversation. But I did start by asking Jill and Margot to share their thoughts on plot, on genre, on literary fiction, and we went from there. I hope you have as much fun listening as we did speaking about this subject and their new novels, The Boy in the Field and Hieroglyphics. If at any point you're not sure who's speaking, keep in mind that Margot grew up in Scotland and Jill is from North Carolina. and I sound like me.
I have so many thoughts. One is that a number of years ago, I was talking to Marilyn Robinson at the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and she said that up until the universities of Oxford and Cambridge decided to make English literature a subject, there was no sort of real division between high and low. Mm-hmm. And then once it became a subject at the universities, they started kind of drawing this line, Beowulf, yes. Charlotte Yonge, who wrote Penny Dreadfuls, no. But I do think reading I grew up reading lots of great Victorian novels, and they all had fabulous plots, and I loved those plots. I love when Rochester's horse falls on the ice and he meets Jane Eyre. I love when Pip discovers that the convict Magwitch is his benefactor in Great Expectations. I love how Dorothea gradually begins to understand that Casaubon is not writing the key to world knowledge. I mean, those are such great moments for me. So I think of plot as being, very, very important to writing, whatever form it takes, whether it's Mrs. Dalloway or something much more extensive. And I think it's interesting that most craft books don't say very much about plot, because I think it's just so hard to generalize about plot.
Right. Yeah.
I also think that there's a distinction. You know, when I hear plot, I immediately first thought is the physical plot. But I think there's also an emotional plot. I mean, just in thinking of Margot's novel, The Boy in the Field, we have the physical actions of the finding and everything that happens. But to me, what pulls me in is the emotional plot of the repetition of each kid going back to that place and tracking it. So to me, I think a lot of times what literary fiction offers is a blend of those two. You know, you both have a physical plot and the emotional plot. But it's hard because, I mean, I always admire people who say, you know, they've got this plot and they know everything that's coming. You know, like my literary GPS is just always recalculating and lost, you know. So often I think, you know, mine is so character driven that very often I get to the end of a novel and I have a lot of material without a plot, and a lot of times that physical plot is the last thing. It's like I have a yard full of furniture and no house to put it in, you know, and the last thing to come is some kind of physical, how did he get here? You know, right. What would motivate this move? And then to go back and put the path.
Right.
Yeah.
Can I just make a quick comment on what Jill just said?
Absolutely, yes.
When you were talking, Jill, I at first heard you say the word plot as meaning a plot of land. And I think that's because of the wonderful way in hieroglyphics you have Frank circle the house where he used to live so poignantly, the house where Shelley and her son now live. And there's something about the plots of land in hieroglyphics, both the New England landscape Lil and Frank have lived in for many years and this more southern landscape they've come to, that I think also gives rise to your physical and psychological plot in a wonderful way.
Yeah. That's absolutely so. Yeah. It was so interesting reading these books side by side and just seeing the different approaches. And I actually was thinking we could talk a little bit about openings. One thing that struck me about each of your openings, well, they each imply time, which was interesting to me. But Margot in particular, When I started your book, I had to smile because the very first sentence, do you mind if I read your first sentence? Okay. Your first sentence in The Boy in the Field is, here is what happened one Monday in the month of September in the last year of the last century. And I thought, well, what happens is plot. So that's great. You know. And then I started looking, and I'm sure it was purposeful. You use that expression a lot. Something happened. Something big happened. This happened. And I thought, well, that's really fun. And you start right away by saying something's going to happen. So that was fun. And then with Jill's book, the beginning of Jill's book is lately, which I think sort of implies time also. Shelley hears things in the middle of the night. Actually, could I read the whole thing?
Sure.
Okay. Lately, Shelley hears things in the middle of the night, hinges creaking and papers rustling, but it could be anything. The dog, her son, a mouse, the wind. And she forces her mind to stop right there so she doesn't imagine possibilities that would terrify her, like a killer or a ghost. So obviously, in both of these books, something's happening, you know? And it's right away very clear that something is happening, and it's really exciting in both cases. So I wondered if you want to talk a little bit about openings and whether it's important to you to kind of open with some kind of promise of what's to come or an implication of suspense or by association plot, but that's kind of getting a little too crafty. But anyway, yeah.
I was hoping Jill would say how she came to hieroglyphics, and was that scene with Shelley the original opening scene?
Right, that's also always interesting.
No, well, and I'm happy to go in there. The novel opened for the longest time with Frank, because the clock in my, and I don't want to give too much away, you know, plot-wise, but for me, he's the clock ticking, you know, and I sort of knew that. And so I always thought it needed to open with him. And then I ended up, for another long stretch of time, it opened with Lil because she occupies the most space. And then finally, the reason I went with Shelley is because it's the only time that all four characters appear in the same frame. Mm-hmm. And so it introduced everybody before shifting points of view. And it felt like that might be a little bit of a help then when the shifts came.
Right.
Wow. Okay.
But I love the power of the word it, you know, like a lot of my favorite openings, like Carson McCullers, you know, it happened, that crazy green summer, or doesn't the bell jar, you know, it, where she opens with, I don't know if there's an it, I'd have to look back, but it's the summer the Rosenbergs were executed, and it just immediately promises, you know, this it, this unknown, immediately does let us know where, you know, we're waiting.
Yes.
For me, I think the opening is so crucial because it's where you make your bid for the reader's attention, where you say, I have a story to tell. Please, please wait and listen to me. You know, like the Ancient Mariner stopping people. And I feel like beginnings bear a lot of weight. And we're very conscious of that, I think, writing, which is why often I'll go back to the beginning over and over, especially when I finally glimpse what the novel is maybe about. And I'll think, oh, that needs to go near the opening, and that needs to go near the opening. And there's often a lot of furniture moving at that stage.
Like Eva or Ava.
I was going to say like Eva.
Great. Okay. So that actually relates. Both of you have said something about not being quite sure where your plot is going from the very start. So I thought that I would ask you, I kind of imagined that you aren't planners of plot, but I don't want to assume anything. So did the novel that you wrote resemble at all the initial vision that you had for it? And was there a vision as far as plot, I guess? Yeah.
I don't plot out my novels in advance, but I do have a destination. Mm-hmm. And in The Boy in the Field, that was the case. There was a place I was heading to, but as Jill said earlier about her GPS, my GPS often took me down down dead end roads and ravines and all kinds of marshes and bogs.
Right. Remember in the early days of GPS, you'd literally find yourself in like a field.
But I did have this place I was heading to while I, you know, plodded along through the undergrowth.
Okay. All right. How about you, Jill?
I did as well. I mean, I had fixed in my mind where Frank is at the end. And that stayed the same.
Okay. All right. Wonderful. What do you do when you don't know what happens next? Do you need to know what happens next to be actively writing? Or are you able to actively write by just sort of working on character and detail and, let's say, setting?
That's what I do. When I'm not quite sure where it's going, I find myself really turning in to a more specific aspect of that character's life. And a lot of times, you know, it just spins you out in the right direction. I don't have one, but you know, those Roomba vacuum cleaners and the way they, I guess, get in a corner and just keep bumping, you know, until something dislodges and sends them in another direction. And so I often tell my students it's not a waste of time. You know, if there's a lot of work that doesn't get used, if what it does is helps you get out of that field we were talking about.
Or the corner, I like that too.
Back on the main highway. And so for me, the best way to do that is to either, you know, focus on some aspect of that character's life, an interest, the career, the hobby, or even to revisit something that's already happened and been told one way with somehow a different view of it.
Okay, great. Let's see. I want to talk about your narrators. And in both cases, these books have multiple narrators, which I thought was really interesting. I loved it because it offered different styles of telling the story. And in both cases, that was really important. So in Hieroglyphics, for example, Lil is narrating pretty much from a grounding in the past and from the things that she's collected and saved, the pieces of her life that help her remember her life. And so very appropriately, hers is a sort of meandering and you know, not quite direct narration, which I just loved. Whereas Frank, you know, is also concerned with his past, but he's very directed and focused on how he wants to approach resolving things for himself. And I don't want to give anything away either, so I'm not going to go farther with that. But then in The Boy in the Field, there's this quote, "If Zoe was the one who found things, their little brother was the one who noticed them." And Duncan and Zoe are affected by the experience of finding this boy in the field much differently than Matthew, whose response is to basically try to solve the crime, which is really fun. So, I mean, just like having all these different things come together just made the stories so much more exciting. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about choosing a narrator or multiple narrators and deciding who gets to tell what part of the story.
I think I had the fantasy at one point that I might be able to write something in the omniscient point of view. I mean, it's always seemed to me the kind of grown-up point of view. And, you know, I see it up there on a pinnacle that I'm striving to reach. But as soon as I finished my opening chapter, I realized that the plot of my novel, in the several senses that Jill so gracefully described, really depended on the differences in point of view, the different way the character saw the world. And so it felt very crucial to use the three points of view, the close third for each of my three main characters.
Right.
And yeah, to give up on being grown up once again.
Okay. Jill?
Yeah. I felt like all four are sort of in different places in life, you know. So Lil and Frank are so much older, and yet they're experiencing it very differently. She's someone who's determined to shine a light on every dark corner and get the answers and understand all she can. And Frank is very compartmentalized about what he wants to deal with or remember. So Lil is the person who could give the most information, Frank a little less information. Shelly is getting more and more on the surface because she's really hiding her past. And Harvey's too young to have much of a past. So he's all present. So I did have in my mind that they're sort of going from the deepest past, you know, up to the surface.
And I loved the different amounts of things, really, that each of them has to draw on. I remember there's this line where Shelley says the only thing she got from her mother was her blue eyes or something like that. And it's just like compared to Lil, who has every little piece of paper. And it's just that was such a wonderful distinction.
Thank you.
That was fun. Yeah. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about suspense, and not just in the opening pages. We talked a little bit about how the opening pages sort of promise a story, but I thought both of these books offer wonderful suspense, sometimes in small ways and sometimes in larger ways. Does suspense appear organically in your work, or do you kind of work to find ways to introduce it?
Well, I have a wonderful a very frank agent, and she will periodically tell me that something is dull or boring. And I really cannot think of two things I would like to hear less about my work. I think I've got the negative the right way around anyway. So I always picture her, you know, saying, isn't that a little dull? I'm a little bit bored here. But I do think it's important for a novel to have both long and short lines of suspense. You know, that there has to be like, you know, I think of Portrait of a Lady, say, where there's this kind of long line of suspense about whether Isabel Archer will come into her own. And then the many short lines of suspense that sort of runs through the novel. And I think having come to novels by writing short stories, my original impulse was to have lots of epiphanies and lots of moments when chapters kind of made the reader want to close the book and never return, really. And it took me a while to figure out that actually there needed to be a reason for the reader to keep going past the chapter endings.
That
would be a better way to use the chapter endings than I was doing.
There's this, I remember in The Boy in the Field, there's this wonderful moment where Matthew is talking to his father, and his father says something along the lines of, you know, I don't think that you need to worry that the perpetrator will come after you. And there's this great line where it's sort of like he hadn't worried about that at all, but now that's all he's going to think about. And I thought, what a wonderful way to introduce suspense, and such a kind of natural thing to have happen in a family, that this, not what they go through, but just the conversation afterwards, that seems like a small bit of a suspense, but it gave me a whole lot to think about. So
I love that description of the kind of the long and the short of it, because I mean, the boy in the field and his story, that is the long playing suspense.
But you're right.
There's so many other things going on. And I think what intrigues me as both writer and reader, when you have multiple points of view, there automatically is suspense because the reader knows so much more
than any one person
on the page, you know, and it's like as soon as we know there's somebody behind the door and they can jump out or not, you know, but as soon as you have that bit of knowledge, everything's on edge.
Right.
I do love that scene when the father, I mean, I was a kid who every night my dad would come in to say goodnight, very cheerful, singing happy songs, but he always looked under my bed and in the closet. And, you know,
I told him years later, I'm like,
you created this, like, this fear of all the bad things that could jump out.
Right. I was just thinking today about how my father used to say that I wasn't allowed to sleep with the door open, but that I could have four fingers of light. So he would close the door to four, and I'd be like, five, five.
Oh, how, what a great detail that
is. So that's just, and actually, speaking of monsters under the bed, we have poor Harvey just hugging his dog for all his life at night with his eyes squeezed shut. Oh, my goodness, that was heart-wrenching and very suspenseful. So
I must have been projecting.
Well, actually, I have a question for you, because your book is so full of details. They are so fantastic, and they were so, not all of them, but a lot of them are very universal, not universal like everybody, but I just could relate to a lot of them. And I was like, has she just given us every single thing out of every journal in her house? I mean, I feel like you covered everything. Like, we're done. There's no more details left.
Thank you.
No, wonderful.
You know, I think those little things are examples of the spinning when you're trying to figure out how did these characters fit together? Is there a plot they can all, you know, they can find? And so a lot of time is spent, I think, drilling downward.
Right.
With those details.
And of course, it's a wonderful irony of Harvey's dog that she is the world's worst watchdog. I think I'm remembering that it's a she, but I just...
And she's nearly deaf, yes.
I mean, she's right. Completely hopeless of doing any of the... She's a great comfort, but she's no protection.
Yes. Well, he's sort of protecting her, isn't he? Yeah, but we won't go too far down that. I have two quotes to read from your books, because talking about what binds or what links characters, okay? This is from Hieroglyphics. And I think it's Frank. A glaring sun blinds him as he steers toward that place one more time to stand where 74 years ago daylight had come not as a gift, but as a glaring beacon of truth of all that had come to an end. So that's just, I'm focusing on place here. And then this is from The Boy in the Field, and it's Zoe. In Oxford, she went first to the cafe where they had drunk tea. Two women, each with a round-headed baby on her lap, sat at their table, oblivious to its historic importance, which I just loved, because the table is the place where she had been with Rufus. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. And I wanted to talk about the role that place plays in our lives, and links people who might have nothing else in common other than this sort of coincidence of place. And yet both of your books sort of in different ways make a place important and then make the people that come into contact with that place important. And that was kind of fun. So I was wondering if we can talk about setting, but I think it's a little bit different than what I'm saying. But if anything comes to mind from that.
Well, I'll go quickly first.
Because I, for the longest time,
I wasn't sure that Harvey and Shelley belonged in the same novel as Lil and Frank, you know, and yet some part of me was just determined to find how they went together. And it's that plot
of land,
you know, as soon as I realized that Harvey was growing up on top of the very place Frank grew up. And experiencing some of the same things, that locked
the two parts together for me.
Yeah. So that didn't start out being something that you had figured out ahead of time, that you worked that out as you went.
No, in fact, I had them living not far where they could see this man, but they weren't in the actual house. I mean, like, why didn't I just start with the real house? But that's one of those examples, you know, where you're just not.
Right.
Or I was not firing all cylinders.
But you had an aha moment, I bet. Like, oh, I know what to do.
Exactly. And then so many other pieces.
Clicked.
Yeah.
I just was thinking how, as a young writer, I think I thought of setting as not incidental, but perhaps accidental. And as I've sort of grown as a writer, I've just come to realize how absolutely crucial setting is, both in the smaller sense of, you know, what's under your bed, and the much larger sense of where you are in the world. And I was thinking, as Jill was speaking, about a playwright I met at the Sewanee Writers' Conference, Tina Howe, years ago, telling me that one of her early plays, she simply couldn't get produced. I think I'm remembering this correctly. And then she moved it. It was set, I don't know, in a cafe or a museum, and she moved it to a beach. And suddenly the whole play worked. Now, there must have been a little bit more to it, but it's one of, when you asked about what to do when you get stuck with the plot, one of the things I do, in addition to what Jill suggests, is I think about whether I can move the characters to a new place. And it might just be going out to the bicycle shed, or, you know, it's not necessarily a very long journey.
And it's not necessarily resetting the whole plot, or the whole novel. You just mean like a scene in another spot.
That can kind of, I don't know, lift the energy again.
Yes. Okay. I noticed, Margot, that after you mention that something happens, literally the word happen, not every time, but sometimes you add a detailed description of setting. I don't know if that was purposeful, but like, do you mind if I read something again? Something enormous had happened. They hurried past the sign for their town, the primary school they had each attended, the church, the pub, and the corner shop, past the houses of their neighbors, past the blousy yellow and white roses in their front garden, and through their blue front door. You know, so it's like, it's very much, so something has happened, we're really excited about it, and then we get a really detailed description of what they're seeing as they go to the next thing, right? So,
And I think one of the things that my characters, or at least that Zoe entertains, is how when you pin a word to an emotion, you limit the emotion, you sort of catalyze it, and how sometimes you just don't know what word to attach to your feelings, or what words, you know, your feelings are just swirling around. And if someone forces you to choose a word, they're also forcing you to limit what you're experiencing.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes my descriptions of setting are a way of trying to maintain a little longer that kind of freedom to have many different interpretations of the emotion or the moment or the feeling.
Yeah, I love what you're
saying,
because that is one of those places listing, you know, as they're making that walk home to that blue door, mm-hmm. Where they all sort of go to their separate little places. You're doing so many things. You're giving us time to absorb the suspense that's on the page, but you're also, yeah, the setting, we're getting to know the place, and the place is so layered with time, you know, the whole sense of that community. And yet it's also the walk they do every day, you know, which is, I mean, I think it's why I'm such a Thornton Wilder fan and go back again and again for that reason, because I think, you know,
there's so much repetition of
these things we see so often in life, we take them for granted, or it's so much part of the everyday. And yet when you see the series over and over several different times, you feel the passage of time, mm-hmm. and change. Mm-hmm. And I felt like Margot did that throughout that whole novel, as they're getting older, as they're each, you know, branching off from their little trio,
yeah.
In so many ways.
Yeah, I enjoyed their family very much.
Oh, I did too. I could not put it down. And I had heard her read from it aloud at Sewanee, so it was just added pleasure.
Just a few more questions. I wanted to know if you've read anything lately that you would recommend to people who are listening, any books by other authors that you might recommend?
Well, I imagine Jill and I will both be recommending our former Sewanee colleague, Randall Keenan's wonderful collection of stories, If I Had a Pair of Wings, which came out from Norton in August and was longlisted for the National Book Award. And it is really a triumph of Randall's artistry. It's all the things he did, was so good at, are there in sumptuous array. So that would be my big recommendation. Some other things that I really liked were Megha Majumdar's A Burning. I really admired the voice of it and the energy and how it took me to a landscape and I didn't know at all. And I really liked Sigrid Nunez's What Are You Going Through? And I don't know if we had to stick to the contemporary, but I just read Willa Cather's A Lost Lady and was really enthralled by her artistry.
Okay. We don't have to stick to anything. Wonderful. Thank you.
Oh, I am so eager to read the Nunez. It's on my list. Randall's story collection. Definitely. Thank you, Margo, that's on my list as well.
I really enjoyed Lily King's Writers and Lovers.
Oh, yeah.
Very much. I think she's a wonderful writer. Natasha Trethewey's memoir, Memorial Drive, which is quite moving, disturbing, but beautifully done, about her mother's death. And I feel like I have read a lot during this stretch, but I recently read Lydia Millett's A Children's Bible, which I enjoyed very much. Kind of a little Lord of the Flies, you know. Here
it's dark, right?
Temporary.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed it very much.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you. I wanted to ask what each of you is working on next, if it's at a stage that you can talk about it, or if you're not superstitious about that.
I'm not superstitious, but I am inarticulate. I'm working on a short novel or a short fictional project, which has the significant advantage that it allows me to go to Scotland every day, where I can't go in reality. But that may be, in fact, its only advantage. So
yeah,
I'm in the floundering stage.
Is it brand new?
I've been writing it since lockdown was declared in March.
Okay, yeah.
I look forward to going to Scotland.
With me, Jill.
Yes, I want to.
And I'm working on short stories.
Some that were in progress before the novel. I tend to work on stories between novels. And I have a lot of
half-baked stories, sort of sketched.
I do tend to sketch stories out in a way that I don't a novel. And so,
oh, interesting.
And so right now, I have quite a few at various different stages that I'm working on.
When you work on stories, do you work on them, I mean, from the standpoint of being a professional, do you work on them with an eye to collection, or do you work on them with an eye to just, you know, finishing a story, being happy with it, publishing it in a journal?
It's so interesting.
I think I'm more novelist
by nature, because what happens is I'll get an idea for a story and I'm working on it and really enjoying it. But then it's like the other ideas for the other stories start to thematically connect somehow. And so a lot of times I do, by the end, I'm thinking of them more as a cluster, not linking, but just thematically.
Right.
Somehow.
Just being able to sit comfortably beside each other.
Yeah.
All right. I like to finish these interviews with advice for authors who are listening, writers who are listening. And in the case of our conversation, I wondered if we could offer advice for authors who are having a particularly difficult time with plot. Maybe they're getting stuck or they just really don't know what's going to happen altogether, even if they have certain things that are going well for them and they don't want to give up the project. So what advice might you have?
Well, I know years ago I was writing a novel called Criminals about a banker who finds a baby in a bus station. And my original idea for the novel was that it would go back and forth between the banker and his sister. And I wrote six chapters like that. And I just hit a wall. I still thought it was a really interesting idea, a really provocative idea, but there just wasn't any energy in it. And I didn't know what to do. So I started casting around for a third point of view. And eventually I thought, well, somebody left the baby in the bus station. I will pursue that person. I will drag them into my plot. And as soon as I opened that new door, the novel began to have energy again. It had become claustrophobic. It was sort of going over the same ground over and over. So I think when I'm stuck with plot, which at the moment is practically every other day, I often sort of look at the characters I've assembled either in the foreground or the background and think, which new character could maybe step forward, or which new door could I open here, even if it doesn't seem to be immediately useful. Mm-hmm. And I think it often requires me looking at something that's already there, but on the page, but in a rather shadowy way, and sort of bringing it forward.
Thank you. That's great. How about you, Jill?
I go back to exercises that were given to me by my very first writing teacher as an undergrad, the writer Max Steele. And he had two exercises that I've continued to use as a teacher.
One is he had us write a 1,000-word
sentence, sort of just in one sitting, that four-page double space, you know, and see where it goes. But the exercise, I call that cleaning out the attic. And really, when I have a lot of different ideas at once, it's very helpful. But my favorite exercise of his is he asked that you get out a piece of paper, and he said, now complete this sentence.
I wish.
So everybody writes a wish. And then he, talked a while, but then ultimately he said to first thing that comes to you, one of your earliest memories.
So you jot down that early memory.
And then the assignment was, how does the wish and the memory, how did they connect?
Cool.
Oh, wow. I like that.
And it almost always works, And so a lot of times, first day of class, I would
do that
and then have people, I would say, if yours connects, I'd love to hear you talk about it. And it was amazing how often, by having stated this wish, the memory that automatically,
came to mind was
related.
So it was one of those exercises in kind of trusting the subconscious, I think, but a lot of fun.
That's really cool. Great advice, both of those. So I want to thank you both so much again for being on the show with me. Margot Livesey's new book is The Boy in the Field, published by HarperCollins. And Jill McCorkle's new novel is Hieroglyphics, published by Algonquin. Thank you so much for joining me to talk about plotting the literary novel.
Thank you so much, Sheila. It was a delight to try to answer your eloquent questions, and I loved hearing more about hieroglyphics and how it came into the world. So thank you, Jill.
Oh, thank you. Thanks to both of you. I've had a wonderful time. Oh, I forgot good. We were doing an interview, which is just a wonderful visit.
That means you really like your work, which is good.
Really honored to be here with you two. So thank you so much.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was a combined interview with Margot Livesey and Jill McCorkle about their new novels, The Boy in the Field, published by Harper, and Hieroglyphics, published by Algonquin. You can learn more about their work at their individual websites, margolivesey.com and jillmccorkle.com. This week, we have four Write the Book prompts, thanks to the generosity of my guests. You've actually heard Jill's prompts. The two exercises she suggested for writers who aren't sure what comes next for their plot was so great that I'm going to repeat them here as well. Jill's teacher, Max Steele, suggested these exercises. First, write a 1,000-word sentence. She says, in one sitting, you want to spend the time to write out that four-page double-spaced sentence, and this will clean out the attic, as Jill puts it. Another exercise that she suggests is to complete the sentence, I wish. Later, and hopefully without actively thinking of how these sentences might thematically relate, write out an early memory. After you've written about these two ideas, see if your wish and memory connect. That's going to be really hard to do now that I've told you that we're looking for a connection. But anyway, maybe get like your cousin to suggest these to you on two different days. Okay, Margot Livesey suggests writing a scene that begins with the question, where were you last night? Or maybe, where were you last night? A second prompt is to take a scene that you've already written and rewrite it from the point of view of another character. This doesn't mean that you should change from first person to third person, but maybe from Millicent to Larry. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. Upcoming episodes of Write the Book will feature local author Ryan Scagnelli, whose debut novel seeks to create empathy and understanding around the subject of depression. And then the week after, I'll air a conversation with Susan Conley, whose new novel is Landslide, and Lauren Fox, author of Send for Me. We're going to be talking about setting in fiction. Both of these books launch in February. This has been an extraordinary and terrible week. But I suggest you not let it distract you from what you need to do to stay safe and to do your work. First, wear a mask. Don't gather with others unless you can assure plenty of distance, preferably outside. Avoid crowds. It might not seem important to consider authors and their new books right now with so much going on, but it still is. Remember what Toni Morrison said. This is a quote. This is precisely the time when artists go to work. There is no time for despair, no place for self-pity, no need for silence, no room for fear. We speak, we write, we do language. That is how civilizations heal. I know the world is bruised and bleeding, and though it is important not to ignore its pain, it is also critical to refuse to succumb to its malevolence. Like failure, chaos contains information that can lead to knowledge. Even wisdom, like art. That was a quote from Toni Morrison about making art during difficult periods of time. So I repeat, as I do every week, please try to find the books that have come out, even as book tours are being canceled. I hope that you are able to read and to write. Keep in mind that the archives of the show offer weekly writing prompts to help you in your work. And they can be a great distraction, too. I mean, if you're finding it hard to work, given all that's going on, if you find yourself anxious and upset, the distraction of just following a writing prompt without thinking of the larger implications of what you're trying to create might be really helpful. I'd love your feedback about Write the Book. I don't get a lot of feedback lately, so I'm going to push this a little harder. Please let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors. The show is booked into the spring, but I still take notes and try to remember what's been suggested to me. If you have events to announce, let me know those. I do announce the Bookworm's calendar on weeks that I have time. If you like the show, please, please, please rate it on the sites where you go for your podcasts. Like it on Facebook. Tweet about it. Talk about it. Get in touch with me and let me know what you think. And if you don't like it, let me know that too. And why? Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We are also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pandora, and lots of other sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. And you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well, stay strong, and have a great week.